Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the Local News Roundup. After a weekend of debate and with early voting underway, South Carolina state senators return to Columbia on Tuesday and vote down redistricting.
The practical deadline for passing this bill was yesterday.
The filing schedule for candidates to become interim mayor of Charlotte is set, and Charlotte City Council schedules a meeting for next week on a proposed 150-day moratorium on future data centers. Obviously, some are against this, but others see it differently.
It's the city doing its job.
A North Carolina House committee plans a hearing in June on the death of 6-year-old Dominic Moody, whose case appears to have required more attention from Mecklenburg DSS. And the Carolina Hurricanes get a little closer to their quest for hockey's Stanley Cup. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is WFAE senior editor Eli Portillo. David Hodges is here. He's an investigative reporter for WBTV. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC TV. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
After spending last Saturday in debate, then adjourning for the holiday, state senators in South Carolina returned on Tuesday to continue debating the passage of a new congressional map that would have wiped out the only Democratic seat in the South Carolina delegation. And then they voted.
By a vote of 26-18, the motion is adopted.
That motion, however, was to reject the new map. How much of a surprise was that, Eli?
I think it was a surprise that they came back to do it after adjourning before. A lot of watchers didn't expect McMaster to call them back. And then I think it was another surprise when they rejected it after it passed the House and they got so far. So kind of a surprise that they went as far as they did and then pulled back at the end. But, it was a little bit premature, I think, victory celebrations occurring on some of the Republican side, because I got a press release before the final vote that said South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson is prepared to defend the new maps and will go to court to block the Democratic challenges. So clearly a surprise to some people on that side as well.
And clearly a setback for Republicans and to Donald Trump, who was asking for redistricting to occur in Republican-controlled states so that the GOP can have a better chance of maintaining control of Congress in the midterms. But it was South Carolina Republicans, senators, who joined Democrats in defeating the move. Republican State Senator Richard Cash.
South Carolina citizens are going to the polls today. And neither my conscience nor my common sense will allow me to stop an election that is already underway. For me, the practical deadline for passing this bill was yesterday.
Senator Cash, by the way, is considered among the most conservative members of the South Carolina Senate. Are we to assume that this would have passed had early voting not already begun? It began at 11. I think it began that morning, and they came back into session at 11 o'clock.
Yeah, I think if they had done it a week ago, it would have had much better odds. It's hard to say a hypothetical, but that was at least enough of a reason to not pass it, that the senators who wanted to vote no, the Republicans who were uncomfortable with it, had a really easy common sense reason they could point to and say, well, look, it's just too late.
Yeah. Mary?
But there's a lot going on here. The early vote, when it started, there was a huge turnout because Democrats had said, get out there in line and show them that you are voting and that it would be really difficult to invalidate all your votes. 45,000 people showed up, which is way more than usual for early voting. So Republicans are already facing headways for the midterms because of the unpopularity of their agenda and of their president. So they were going to rush this through. They were already getting pushback from places like Myrtle Beach and Charleston and Columbia, cities that they were going to break up that have common interests. And so there was no public input. So yes, it was principles, as you're going to say that Congressman Jim Clyburn said, but also it was the practical looking at it and seeing how unpopular this was. You would be saying that 25% or more or thereabouts of the voters in South Carolina, African-Americans, wouldn't have a voice, really echoing and harkening back to Jim Crow. And those votes were going to have to go somewhere. Black voters were going to have to go somewhere. So perhaps it might have eliminated any Democratic representation, but perhaps it would also weaken the standing of Republicans in their districts. So yeah, it was a sense of principle, but it was also a sense of, wait, this may backfire on us.
I want to talk about dummy mandering in a second, but Jim Clyburn, you mentioned him. He's been in office since 1992. This would virtually have eliminated his seat and certainly made it more difficult for him to win. But now the pressure is off. And on Tuesday, he spoke with WFAE News in the aftermath of that vote about why he believed Republican lawmakers resisted pressure from the National Party and from Donald Trump.
Because fundamentally, South Carolinians have a tremendous, very broad, independent streak. So they decided to stand up for the principles and be real good Americans and not allow people to use them this way.
So Clyburn also told WFAE's Nick Della Canale that the Republican state senators were merely maintaining their principles, as you just mentioned, as were set forth in the Constitution. But after the vote, the chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party, Drew McKissick, called this a missed opportunity and said the party would now focus on keeping Donald Trump's agenda moving forward. Mary, Trump is historically unpopular, largely due to his agenda. If you are a Republican politician, why would you want to keep that agenda moving forward?
Well, they also want to keep their seats. And they have seen around the country that while he is historically unpopular, he is still incredibly popular among the base, the MAGA base. And they're going to need that turnout to actually maintain their seats. So they are all putting, you know, their eggs into the Trump basket there because they're doing it for survival. And we've seen other southern states like Louisiana and Alabama and Tennessee follow along to try to redistrict their way into winning in the midterms, whereas in a blue wave, they might not have a chance of keeping that seat. So at this point, the Republican Party is Donald Trump, I think we have to say that. And so that's their only hope. But you have seen with interviews with Trump voters that even some of them, while they may not vote Democratic, some may be so upset about gas prices, war in Iran, and so much more that they might stay home. So they're just trying to gin up that base.
David?
The Republican state senate in South Carolina also has the benefit of time and memory on their side. Their last election was in 2024, and then they have to get elected again in 2028. So that is a while down the road. That gives them some time to allow voter memories to lapse. And then it's also helpful to have a Democrat in your back pocket when elections go the other way. When a Democrat eventually takes over the White House, having a Clyburn representing your state can be helpful to help bring some of that pork home to South Carolina.
Drew McKissick, who, as I said, was the chair of the South Carolina GOP, is not the only South Carolina Republican to express disappointment. South Carolina Attorney General, who you just said was prepared to defend the Democratic challenges should this map had passed. He's also running for governor. Alan Wilson said he saw nothing wrong with this attempt to redraw the districts.
South Carolina is doing the same thing that blue states have been doing for decades. If it's constitutional and it's lawful, we should be able to do it, and that's why I supported it this past time.
And he added, the fight is not over. Is that true? Have blue states worked on redistricting out of the normal redistricting cycle, which happens every 10 years following the census?
Some blue states, yes, have done it, and we see basically, though, in California, where Gavin Newsom is leading an issue they're trying to redistrict to get some Democratic districts back, that it was basically in response to Texas, but also they put it to the voters. They basically put that and let them decide. And voters said, yes, indeed, that they did want to redistrict. Because you've seen in other cases that they're having these nonpartisan redistricting commissions, and they've been trying to move to that A lot of blue states have been doing that, including California, but they're saying that this is an opportunity that they can't really go unarmed. They have to answer the Republicans in kind. And we have seen these red states, basically, they don't take it to the voters. And in states like Louisiana, they're trying to push this through when voters have already started to vote. So it is different. Also, a lot of these states weren't covered by the Voting Rights Act. We have to go, why was there a Voting Rights Act? Well, because African Americans did not have a voice. They were hit with poll taxes and so much more. And so it was needed. And they seem to be forgetting this history of Jim Crow, this history of not allowing African Americans to vote. And that's why it was put in place. And it's interesting because Clyburn basically said, I don't have a majority Black district. You know, we have a history of Black people have often voted for white politicians, but the opposite has not been true. And so Black voters have not had a voice in many of these states.
In fact, his district, I think, is 45% African-American. And there is this question, had Republicans been successful in South Carolina and in other states where they are attempting to do this, that dummy mandering might occur. And that is where you spread the Democrats out along all of these different formerly totally Republican lines, and they could end up diluting the vote and causing the exact opposite of what these lawmakers intend. Another gubernatorial candidate, businessman Ram Reddy, was critical of lawmakers for failing to pass these maps.
They wait for presidential leadership to all jump to social media and say, yes, I'm for it, and I'm for it. And then they can't get it done. They can't get anything done.
Many GOP candidates for governor had something to say about this defeat. Here's Rock Hill's Ralph Norman.
As governor, we will put it back up. I thought that the General Assembly would never pass it because most of them don't want it.
If Norman wins the governor's race and puts this bill back up, why would he expect it to pass if the General Assembly members don't want it? Does that make any sense?
Well, the General Assembly members who voted no, I believe, will all be up for re-election by 2028. And that is a pressure point, you know, as we've seen with Senator Cornyn and other perceived Trump-designated rhinos, Republicans in name only, people who aren't strong enough for their side being voted out in the primaries. So there will be a lot more pressure than right now where, you know, these state senators are not up for election right now.
David.
They're all saying this right now because they're all in a primary to get elected in the GOP currently. Whether or not they're going to be beholden to what they say a year from now, whoever ends up getting elected, it might not even be an issue. Trump probably will not care about redistricting past this November. So, you know, what they promise today for redistricting tomorrow might not really matter.
Yeah, they're all trying to out-Trump Trump right now. And as David said, that's it. That's it. That's they want to be elected governor. So how can they distinguish themselves?
And Representative Nancy Mace, also in the gubernatorial race, also wanted to see these maps pass.
This was a Supreme Court decision in Alabama that determined that we could not draw lines based on race. And this was an opportunity for our state to right the wrongs of the past.
Mary, I have 30 seconds. What exactly is she saying here?
Well, she's twisting it around, obviously, because we see them breaking up cities that are majority African-American. So I think this is a kind of a twisted way to interpret the Voting Rights Act. But then again, the Supreme Court has shown that it is willing to go along with her interpretation.
The race to be interim mayor in Charlotte now has a date set for your applications. Should you want to throw your hat in the ring, we'll tell you more about that in a moment. Also, the Charlotte data centers, they're joining throngs around the country, people being opposed to these being in their area, and we'll talk about that too. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, offering an international curriculum and IB diploma program for high school students designed to help prepare them for college, careers, and a global community. BISCharlotte.org.
It's the local news roundup on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor for WFAE News. David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. Hunter Sines, who we'll hear from shortly, is a reporter at WSOC-TV. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Almost immediately after Mayor Vi Lyles announced that she would step down on June 30th, the woman she beat years ago to take that office, Jennifer Roberts, made it known that she is ready and she is interested in becoming the interim mayor. And this week, longtime Charlotte City Councilman James Smudgy Mitchell pitched himself to his colleagues on council. By law, they will make the decision. Council will make this decision. And he sent a vision of his leadership in an email to his colleagues. What did he say, Eli?
Well, he said he wants the job and also that he would not run again. So that he is basically saying, give this to me as an interim and I won't be throwing my hat in the ring for the open seat. He's been around for a very long time. He has served on council before, taken a break, come back. So it's going to be interesting to see if anyone can get to six, because I will talk about this a bit more, but the meeting on Tuesday, I think it's fair to say, was a little bit torturous as they determined their process.
He had a slew of proposals in that email, among them creating committee vice chairs. If that were to happen, that would mean that every single member of city council would either chair or vice chair a committee.
Yeah, and that would be a return to a previous structure, Mayor Lyles has, I believe this term, gotten rid of the vice chairs because, like you said, everyone, it's kind of like everybody gets a star, yay. but bringing them back, I think, is a carrot he could offer to try to get some votes from his colleagues.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that a way to sweeten the pot?
New council members and who don't see a way to get any kind of leadership anytime in the near future. A vice chair is a great gold star, as Eli pointed out.
Lyles' interim replacement must be from her party. She's a Democrat, so both Jennifer Roberts and Mitchell check that box. They must also live in Charlotte. That box is checked. And although it isn't a requirement, you can assume that council will want them to not run again once they're an incumbent in office in 2027. Jennifer Roberts already said that she would not run again. As you pointed out, Mary, so did James Smudgy Mitchell, but WSOC-TV's Joe Bruno hammered home that question to James Mitchell.
Now, what if 2027 comes around, the Black Political Caucus is telling you to run, the business community is telling you to run, then what happens?
I have to say a word that's hard for me to say, no.
This clip will be shared and shared and shared if you ultimately choose to run, but that's not going to happen.
Not going to happen, Joe.
Yeah, we have the tape now. We have it on tape. If a person doesn't want this job permanently, why would you want it at all?
Well, you do get it for 17 months. So, I mean, it's almost a full term, considering it's only a 2-year term. So, also, you know, he has shared that he's been treated for bladder cancer. So it is a way to have the job for almost a full year.
Yeah.
And for Smudgy not to go through the rigors of a primary campaign.
And he, in his email to his colleagues on council, he did council, he referenced the close of his public service career. That's a quote. Is this the first time we've heard that from Mr. Mitchell?
I'm not sure what language he used when he left council 4 or 5 years ago, when he was the part owner of a development company, and it turned out he had to leave because of that, doing business with the city. I don't remember.
It was similar language.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't remember the exact words he used, but I think it was similar language.
Mary.
And even though it's not a permanent job, obviously, it's a very visible one. We have a weak mayor system, but our last few mayors have really made it a very prominent leadership position. If you want to have a prominent position in Charlotte, if you want to have a future in politics, this is really a showcase. And I think a lot of people might want to have it. And actually, anybody can apply if you meet those criteria from June 2nd to June 9th. So folks, if you want to be mayor of Charlotte, you You have some chance to put your hat in the ring.
Hunter?
I was going to say the whole weak mayor system. I mean, to answer your question, I think part of this, Mike, is also just the notoriety of having the job, especially to cap off his political career. And some of it is you have influence as the mayor, but you don't have a whole lot of power. And to remind people that, yes, anybody can apply, but historically, when we have a vacancy either on council or in the mayor's office, they usually go with a stakeholder who is pretty well known amongst the political elite in this town. Yeah.
So filing begins on June 2nd. It goes through June 9th. Anybody can apply if you're a Democrat. I don't know your political affiliation, Hunter or David, but you have good hair, and that's one of the requirements for any politician. And
my hair, Mike. I mean,
I'm affiliated, for the record, just for all the listeners out there.
Yeah, I mean, that might be a necessary but not sufficient. You know, we've seen some people with great hair not win Charlotte mayor. I'm thinking of Edwin Peacock. Great head of hair.
Okay, so they're going to make a decision by June 22nd, they say, but Via Lyles has said that she will stay on longer if they don't make that decision by then. Yesterday morning, Mecklenburg County Commissioner Yvette Townsend Ingram announced on Facebook that she had recently undergone open-heart surgery and now needs a heart transplant. She's missed several meetings, that's why, obvious reasons there. Did we have any inkling of the severity of her physical condition prior to yesterday?
I don't think so. At least I had not heard that it was that severe. You know, I think some people had noticed that she was missing county meetings. There's been a little more attention on the county with budget season right now. And the questions about how much money they'll give CMS, whether there will be a property tax increase. So, you know, it was kind of noticed that she had missed some meetings. But obviously needing a heart transplant is extremely serious, more than just a passing illness.
She's on the ballot, or she will be on the ballot for re-election in 2020, in November rather, because she's running unopposed. Do we know if she will continue to be in that race?
I don't believe she said so, whether or not yet.
So she was told by her physician of the need for a new heart on April 22nd due to severe heart disease, which she says runs in her family. But for now, she says, I'm alive and I feel good, and we wish her the best. Data centers, they have become a hot topic here and around the country. In fact, the University of Arizona just released this week a study showing that these data centers, like cities, become heat islands. They say that nearby neighborhoods experience an increase in temperature of as much as 4 degrees because of the heat generated by these data center. So add that to the noise pollution, the concerns over water use, the concerns over rising power bills, something else for the debate to consider as it rages on. And it did on Tuesday at the Government Center, where City Council considered a 150-day data center moratorium. Cybersecurity expert Ethan White supports that effort.
The 150-day moratorium is not a rejection of this technology. It's the city doing its job.
But land use attorney Colin Brown opposed any moratorium, though his opinion was not appreciated by all.
I do think the data centers are becoming critical infrastructure for communities. I think so. I think they are just like becoming like utilities and roads.
These two stances don't seem unreasonable, and they do seem to be able to peacefully coexist. You can acknowledge the role that data centers play in modern life while also taking time to be cautious about them, can't you?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's what council is trying to balance. You know, there are a lot of things that are indispensable to modern life that we don't put in the middle of neighborhoods or next to residential areas. You know, we put power plants farther away. We put industrial recycling sites away from neighborhoods. Historically, that hasn't always been the case. Many lower income and black neighborhoods have been targeted by those sites. So I think council is also aware of that and wants to avoid repeating those mistakes. At the same time, like Colin Brown was saying, I do struggle with, you know, it reminds me of that line in The Godfather Part 2 when Don Corleone, the younger, says, Senator, we're both part of this hypocrisy. We all use data centers. I mean, I don't see anyone ditching their cell phone and social media and Netflix and YouTube and Amazon, and all of that stuff is basically a data center. None of it exists without data centers. Right. So it's not reasonable for me to think we're going to ban data centers like some of these people were asking, but we do need some safeguards, some understanding of the impacts, and some better rules about where they can go and how those impacts can be mitigated.
In fact, we are using data centers to do this program right now. Lawyer Bruce Thompson believes a timeout, however, would give local officials time to learn, gather information, and update their policies, but he had a word of caution.
I caution anybody looking at a moratorium just to make sure that if they do it, that they're not sending a message that a particular type of business isn't welcome in our state, because there are a lot of great examples across North Carolina where a data center has really been transformational, you know, for a county.
David, these moratoria, the push for moratoria across is happening across the country. It's happening all through North Carolina. It's also happening all across America. Is this an organic movement, or is something or someone or some organization behind it?
It mostly appears organic, although there is some reporting and some allegations that there are other entities at play funding money towards the opposition movement towards data centers. However, I don't think you see Robert Dawkins and others from the Charlotte community come out because they're getting big checks cashed by some other foreign entity. So it's most likely a mix of those things, but it's clearly incredibly politically unpopular right now to have a data center come up in your community. And I think a lot of politicians have really figured out that this could be their topic, their issue, to kind of ride into some more popularity, especially as some of these things like the Charlotte mayor race comes up for play. I think the big challenge, though, that Eli was kind of referring to is exactly, you know, what is the combination of we don't want these in our communities, but we need these here. I see a lot of people saying, well, let's put them out in the middle of nowhere. Well, they kind of target some areas like cities and communities because there is access to water, there is access to electricity. So just sticking it out in the middle of the mountains or the plains somewhere in Kansas might not be viable.
And those people also have agency and push back. You know, those people in Kansas are also pushing back very strongly. So they don't want the things there either.
Data centers have existed in Charlotte for quite a while, and they've peacefully coexisted among uptown Charlotte and other locations. But these are not the size of these data centers that are being proposed now, which are incredibly massive. Meanwhile, York County, South Carolina leaders will soon vote on whether to set up a 9-month moratorium on data centers to allow time for that county to look into zoning and land use regulations. So there's more to come on this. WFAE's Julian Berger reported this week, Eli, that last November, the city of Charlotte set aside $100,000 to help households financially impacted by U.S. Border Patrol's Operation Charlotte's Web. As of today, none of that money has been used. Why not?
So the city of Charlotte set up this fund using some of their housing assistance dollars that had been set aside previously, and they contracted with Crisis Assistance Ministry to say, okay, you get people to apply, people who maybe they lost a job because their business closed or they're too afraid to send their kids to school, so they've been staying home with their kids and can't work, people who lost income. You can apply through crisis assistance to access this city money. What happened was there were requirements in there for people to be documented with things like social security numbers, and crisis assistance said that nobody who was documented applied for this money. And they said that the city's requirements ended up making this money useless because the people who lost income were not able to be show documentation as citizens or legal residents. So they ended up getting 3 applications, and because they didn't meet those city requirements, Crisis used their own funds to pay those people. The city took all the money back and redirected it to other housing assistance programs. So kind of a big disappointment for advocates for immigrants, and I think a good demonstration of the need to follow up on splashy announcements.
So following a six-month investigation, the FBI and CMPD conducted a raid on a hotel in Northeast Charlotte on Wednesday that resulted in 11 indictments, 10 arrests at the time, along with a filing of civil forfeiture of the Charlotte Garden Inn and Suites. Russ Ferguson is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina.
The Garden Inn has become this rampant and pervasive hub of drug trafficking and gun trafficking activity. It has been a problem hotspot that is causing problems throughout the Charlotte community.
Hunter, what led to this six-month investigation?
So I think in part what started this whole thing were the sheer amount of 911 calls over the years to this Garden Inn. From January of last year, or of 2024, to middle of this month, there were nearly 600 911 calls specifically to this hotel, with nearly 50 arrests that were made in that time span at that hotel. We've known that the Sugar Creek Corridor, even the community who lives around there, has called for cleanup on the corridor, for changes when it comes to preventing and lowering violent crime. And based on confidential informants, undercover operations and surveillance, they were able to see that it wasn't just one or two one-off deals, allegedly. It was a whole facilitation of drug deals coming out of multiple stash rooms, it sounds like, in this hotel.
U.S. Attorney Ferguson says that this hotel is in a part of Charlotte that, quote, should be thriving. It's a part of Charlotte that is affordable, but it's also a part of Charlotte that is not safe. And here's why.
The hotel itself serves as almost like a farmer's market for drugs and guns. There are multiple rooms on multiple levels where people are buying guns and drugs.
So that was what he said on Wednesday. Who did they arrest?
They arrested 10 people, including what he said was basically the spearheaded effort behind this, which was the security team employed by the hotel itself, including the head of security, who was operating and allegedly facilitating all of this. And it's also the security team that federal prosecutors allege never helped CMPD in any of their calls of service there. There's documentation of gunmen walking past with guns past security and them saying they never saw anything.
We have more to say about that, because this is also involving the forfeiture of that property from the owner, which we'll get to when we come back, along with some housing for teachers and a compliance assessment at CMS. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Eli Portillo is here, senior editor for WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. David Hodges is an investigative reporter for WBTV. And Hunter Sines is with us, a reporter at WSOC-TV. We're just talking about a major drug bust this week at the Charlotte Garden Inn and Suites, in which 11 people were indicted, 10 were arrested, many of them security guards employed by that hotel. And Channel 9 Hunter reports that some of the members of the hotel security team, quote, had extensive criminal records and were either active or previously documented gang members. Who owns that hotel?
So I am not comfortable sharing the name of who owns it, because she has not yet been criminally charged, but in the civil forfeiture, she is, she says she is the owner and the general manager, but there was also a former owner who is playing part in this too. Long story short, to what you're pointing out, the head of security allegedly had an ankle monitor on him while being head of security. Another one, if not him, had multiple arrests, including arrests for murder. So those are the type of people that the feds say we were dealing with here in this investigation.
David, WBTV reports, although Hunter doesn't want to use the name, WBTV reports that CMPD asked Jessica Woodard to cooperate with an investigation into a shooting, and she didn't comply. And Russ Ferguson, the U.S. attorney, says the hotel, quote, created the crime there instead of stopping it. And that's why we filed our action today to seize the hotel. How unusual is it for them to seize a piece of property like that?
Well, and they haven't seized it yet. They have to go through the entire court process of trying to do that. It is pretty unusual, but it's not unprecedented. And I've actually reported on this issue before. Back in 2021, there was a string of a strip mall on West Boulevard and Remount Road where almost the exact same thing happened. It was called the West Boulevard Shops, and CMPD and federal authorities worked together. The U.S. Attorney's Office filed a seizure complaint like this. But instead of the property getting seized, it was instead sold to the city of Charlotte, who then recently transferred it to a private property owner. And that entire strip mall is still surrounded by chain link fence, and absolutely nothing has happened to it 5 years later. So this is far from a straightforward process now. And what I was speaking with community members like Ricky Hall and others at the time in the West Boulevard corridor there, they pointed out that seizures had happened back in the 80s even there. And often what it does is, instead of fixing the problem, it just kind of kicks it down the road a little bit. So it could slow or stop the crime for right now, but it's by no means like a complete fix.
Hunter.
U.S. Attorney Russ Ferguson explained the two ways that this can go. Either when they seize it, if they actually get permission from a judge to seize that property, the federal government can auction it off, in which you don't really have a say on who gets the property or what it turns into. It could very well get into the ownership hands of somebody who lands us right back to these types of incidents. Or you can strike a deal with the current owner where she would get 20% of the profits, the feds would get 80%, but the feds would have a direct say with the conditions of who it goes to. In other words, you have to share your surveillance video, you have to do background checks on the security you hire. So they would have more control in that way.
And people live at this hotel. What has happened to the people who are living there? Are they still allowed to live there?
Yes, for now they are. Anybody who was innocent, not arrested, not charged, again, it's not seized yet. They will still be able to live there. If it goes under new ownership, like in the past, there have been nonprofit organizations that help to rehome those individuals in other circumstances.
The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board took a step this week toward creating something they've been planning for a while, an educator community of roughly 100 units of affordable housing for teachers. They've been discussing this for a couple of years now. Eli, what happened to move it forward?
So they have voted to lease a parcel of land adjacent to Garinger High School, which the school board owns, to a private developer who... for a nominal fee. It's like for $100 a year or something like that. So basically, they will gift that land to this private developer, and the private developer will seek to build 100 units of affordable housing, which would be reserved for educators at CMS. Yeah. And they have about a year from now to arrange their financing. They still don't have all the money. They got $1 million from the city for kind of a pre-commit to help with planning, but they still need to go out and raise their tax credits and their private investor backing to actually build this now.
There has been some pushback over the past over concerns by teachers that this is merely a Band-Aid to answer for low pay. But CMS board member, and I hope I say her name correctly, Shamaya Haynes, says this will not replace efforts to push for higher salaries.
I just want people to understand that this is a both and kind of a situation.
And she says she and other board members stressed that this was an effort to address Charlotte's growing affordable housing crisis while meeting teacher needs. The decision, by the way, was unanimous. So when will this development start? When will it be completed? What, in fact, will it consist of?
So it could start as soon as next year if they are able to lock down their financing by then. Construction, you know, will probably take a couple years. We've got 100 units of housing. And like you said, some of the pushback from teachers has been like, OK, it's a flashy project. Is this just a Band-Aid? They really just want more money in their pay so they can afford housing more easily in general. And then it's worth pointing out, you know, there are more than 9,000 teachers and many more thousand support staff educators. So 100 units of affordable housing for them doesn't solve too much.
Sticking with CMS, go ahead, Mary.
I just want to say, and we've seen, though, even though they say it's they also want to go for higher salaries, that North Carolina has had problems recruiting teachers because as the pay has shrunk and surrounding states are offering higher pay. So this is a continuing problem. And so we can see how the teachers are complaining that, okay, you're throwing us this up, but what we really need, you know, higher salaries. And there's always a teacher shortage in the state right. and in the city.
So sticking with CMS for a moment, the board plans to hire an outside firm now to conduct a broad, wide-ranging compliance assessment of the district's policies, procedures, and practices. Eli, why?
So this has been in the works for a while, and our education reporter, James Farrell, spoke to the board chair, Stephanie Sneed, this week, and she basically said, look, we have a $2 billion budget, and we're spending $2 billion in bond-funded capital plans. And, you know, it's important that we just do a compliance audit and make sure we're dotting our I's and crossing our T's. So she did not respond with any specific issues they've had.
Here's precisely what she said.
We have a over $2 billion budget, and we also have, you know, over $2 billion bond as well. So to make sure that we are identifying the areas that we need improvement on, or that we have the greatest risk, or things that we're doing well.
So this review would include human resources and the finance department. Board Chair Stephanie Steed says this was not prompted by any specific concerns, but does it shed light on the kerfuffle over the budget that Crystal Hill presented that was first rejected and then accepted with some changes, and the closed-door personnel meetings that they held around that same time? Does this have anything to do with that?
So I don't think it has to do with that in the sense of being directly prompted by it, but it is certainly raising eyebrows and raising questions that, you know, there's been all this tension between Superintendent Hill and the board that's been exposed and boiled up in the past couple months. And now the board is moving forward with a really wide-ranging compliance audit. You know, they're not directly related as far as we know. Like I said, the compliance audit has been in the works for a while, but it's definitely drawing a lot more attention now because we know that there is more scrutiny on the superintendent and the administration. Also, the school system still has not hired a new attorney or since the previous attorney who is kind of the buck stops here with compliance person in the organization. So that is another thread of this that's ongoing right now. And it's definitely drawing more scrutiny than it would have if the budget process had gone smoothly.
I don't want to run out of time before we get a chance to talk about this. Both WBTV and WSOC-TV did extensive investigations into the death of six-year-old Dominique Moody, who died, I think, in December of last year. And it raised those investigations raised almost as many questions as they answered. She died after enduring abuse and inhumane living conditions, according to CMPD. And after multiple visits to the home, Mecklenburg County's Department of Social Services closed the case each time due to a lack of evidence. And now a state house committee in the General Assembly is planning to hold a hearing on this. Hunter, why has it come to their attention?
I think the notoriety of just how severe of a case this was came to the attention of Majority Leader Representative Brendan Jones, who has called in the past after the Irina Zarutska light rail murder, has called our local leaders to Raleigh to testify before. But he believes the public deserves to know what went wrong here and why this little girl fell so far in the cracks to where she died the way she did.
The House Oversight Committee, David, claims that Mecklenburg County failed Dominique Moody. That's an exact quote, adding the public deserves to know how a child could die under such unspeakable conditions. Another quote. They've called Mecklenburg County Manager Mike Bryant to testify, along with CMPD Chief Estella Patterson, who I don't think was in charge at the time. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden has been called to testify, along with two others. When will this take place? And what is the likely outcome of this hearing? Will they do anything if they find that we were deficient?
It's scheduled for next Thursday, I believe. And they're going to have a lot of questions. And what could come out of it is maybe some tinkering with a bill that's already been filed to address some of the issues that are believed to have been behind Dominique Moody's death. That bill is being pushed by Representative Alan Chesser, who's going to be overseeing this committee. He and Sheriff Gary McFadden had a difficult time at the last Oversight Committee hearing, that's for sure, to say the least. But I definitely think that there will be some very pointed questioning about exactly what happened, how there can be more oversight, how the state could get more involved potentially to make sure something like this doesn't happen again. Whether it's direct punishment, maybe not, but it could be helpful in shaping a bill and a new law.
It's been a couple of weeks now since the State House and Senate leaders, Destin Hall and Phil Berger, announced forward movement on the budget, but we still don't have a budget. And in the balance, pay raises for teachers and state employees are hanging. State Employees Association of North Carolina is not happy with the proposal they've seen so far for 3% raises. They say it's not going to cut it amid inflation. Artis Watkins is the State Employees Association, is with that organization, and spoke with WUNC's Colin Campbell for their politics podcast, telling him that what teachers, state employees, and law enforcement are proposed to receive just is not enough.
They're still making phone calls and sending emails, because right now what they're thinking is this isn't done. And maybe they don't get it. Maybe they don't honestly think we're that angry. And they want it to be clear that they are, that they feel that disrespected by this.
And some have suggested the state could eliminate some positions across the state agencies to afford these raises. And Watkins says that would not be smart. And she used the DMV as an example.
Since 2009, the number of state employees who are on the job has decreased in North Carolina because we have jobs frozen right now. We have added 2 million taxpayers, 2 million citizens since 2009. So things like DMV happen when you do exactly that. You don't increase the number of employees you have. How you would cut any more is mind-blowing to me.
Is this getting talked about in the General Assembly, Eli?
Yes, although I don't think that, you know, there's much wiggle room to change the headline numbers now. You know, they've been wrestling over this for more than a year or since last session. So I don't think they're going to suddenly say, boy, you know, they're right. All those state employees, now we think everyone should get 10%. And part of the issue here is they've directed the bulk of these raises towards really hard to fill positions like prison guards. And the state employees representatives, you know, they're saying, look, we understand those are hard to fill, but a lot of these positions are, we believe, underpaid, and it's not fair. So that's a lot of the pushback you're seeing right now.
Prediction markets are under the microscope, like Kalshi and Polymarket. They allow you to bet on just about anything, but they now may be off limits for certain people and purposes. Governor Josh Stein just issued an executive order this week banning state employees who have access to inside information in participating.
People need to have faith that their public servants are working on their behalf, not leveraging their knowledge unfairly to win a bet and make money.
How prevalent has this become in state government, and will a gubernatorial executive order, can it be overturned?
Well, that I don't know, but I was thinking, like, okay, what are state employees going to bet on? Like, how long the wait times are at the DMV, or how many trout get stocked in, you know, Lake Lure this year? I don't know. But then I remembered, college sports. And even high school sports now, you know, you've got state employees involved in that. So I think we've seen Army soldiers like the one out of Fort Bragg being charged over betting on the Maduro raid. I think they're really trying to get ahead of this before something happens. And especially when you're talking about athletics.
Before we leave, we should mention that Wilfried Zaha is leaving Charlotte FC in June because his loan contract is up. That's something they do in soccer. And speaking of soccer, there's going to be a game this Sunday as kind of a preview of the World Cup, USA versus Senegal. The Carolina Ascent, the women's professional soccer team, is advancing to their league championship on Saturday. And the Hurricanes have been dominating the Montreal Canadiens, David. They play again tonight, and they might be on the road to the Stanley Cup, right?
They could, but my my analysis and prediction of sports on this show is awful, so I'm not going to get into it.
Good. David Hodges, we're out of time. David Hodges, Hunter Sines, Mary C. Curtis, Eli Portillo. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.